My grandmother and George could not read newspapers, and a wireless radio set which might have kept them in touch with events was too expensive for them to buy. They had absolutely nothing to talk about except local gossip or the small happenings of their working days, and by night both of them were too tired, or too dispirited to be interested in each other's daily routine. George would stare into space, smoking his evil-smelling clay pipe, and Ran would sew in silence until it was time to retire. Often I would go out, even if I had nowhere to go, just to avoid these dull, deadly silent evenings around the kitchen idiresis negationary. I would sometimes go to spiritualist meetings hoping I might get some message to tell me how to set about serving humanity, but in those days there was never any message for me, and since the other older members of the congregation did not speak to me or try to be friendly, I was not able to contact any group of people with whom I might sit to develop my mediumship as I had been told to do. I began to be very depressed and to wonder if the letters could possibly have been some kind of elaborate hoax. But I kept returning to the fact that the woman in Munich could not possibly in any ordinary way have learned the name and address of a totally unimportant young man in a small English town, and even if she had been able to do so, what on earth would be the point in playing a complicated joke on a total stranger whose reaction you would never see? I got very broody pondering on these matters, and my grandmother offered to dose me with sulfur and syrup, which was her cure for all ills. I turned down her offer of the loathsome sulfur and syrup and decided I must snap out of it by my own efforts, so I made up my mind to take up dancing again. Miss Florence said she was delighted to see me. She had been doing so well in recent months she was hardly able to cope with all the pupils who wanted to enroll. It seemed that England had gone dance mad, because young, middle-aged and old all wanted to learn to do the quick step, the tango, the new waltz, the black bottom and the rest. It was agreed I would help with slow learners and new pupils in return for private dance lessons from Miss Florence. I went back to dancing with all the enthusiasm of a stranded idiresis negationish returned to water. I practiced steps in the shop between jobs, I practiced in my bedroom under George's jaundiced eye, I waltzed and tangoed through my grandmother's lines of washing in our kitchen, and when I wasn't dancing with my feet, I was working out routines in my head. When Miss Florence said that if I persevered I might even make a career in dancing, I was thrilled. The manager's assistant at the shop was unexpectedly transferred to another branch of the company, and the manager offered me his job. Not only did I get to rise in pay to 15 shillings a week, but I would be allowed to wear a black coat and pinstripe trousers, purchased at cost price from the shop. Despite my rise in status, I still had to sweep out, polish and dust the shop in the morning and clean the show windows as before. But when I had finished these tasks, I would slip into the back shop and change from my overalls into my smart shop suit, and I felt no end of a dude. I was also allowed a discount on clothes from the shop, and I was allowed to pay by installments. In this way I was able in time to get together a wardrobe. I bought two suits, a dark blue serge suit and, to express my more dashing side, a plum-colored worsted suit. I bought a pair of the new white flannel trousers known as Oxford bags and a tweed jacket. The two together cost me under £8.2, and then I bought myself a raincoat, which set me back 25 shillings. Thus accoutred, I thought I was quite a dandy. Each time I brought home some new item, my grandmother would remark pointedly that clothes never yet made the man, but secretly she was very proud of my new image, and she spent hours sponging, pressing and steaming so that I should always be immaculate. George never, to my knowledge, wore anything other than his working corduroys and a blue-striped union shirt with a neckerchief, and he regarded my pretensions with sardonic amusement, because I fell so far short of what he called real gentry. The first time I wore my plum-colored confection, he lay on the old horsehair sofa in the kitchen and laughed until he cried. After I had been with Miss Florence as pupil teacher for some months, a girl joined the class who I thought was a natural-born dancer. Her name was Gladys, and she was small, slim and lissome as a dryad, with brown hair and big hazel eyes. Her clothes were of the simple elegant kind, which I suspected must have cost a great deal. We liked each other from the beginning and our steps suited so well I was sure I had found the ideal partner I had dreamed about for so long. As soon as I plucked up enough courage I asked her to go to one of the local dances with me and to my joy she accepted the invitation. On the big night, wearing my blue serge and my most tasteful tie, I arrived outside the front door of the address Gladys had given me and my heart sank into my gleaming shoes. This was the home of wealthy and important people whose daughter was far beyond my poor reach. However, I rang the bell thinking I would at least have one night to remember before her wrathful parents gave me the heave-ho. The door was opened by a maid servant in black and white trim, and I asked nervously if Miss Gladys was ready to accompany me to the dance. The maid giggled, then quickly controlled herself. "Go round to the side door and ring the bell," she said abruptly and then closed the door in my face. I walked around the house to the side door wondering if the servant's curt behavior was the first sign of parental disapproval, and I pressed the bell. Gladys, wearing a white fur jacket over a flame-colored evening gown, opened the door to me. "Cook might give us a sherry if she is in the mood, so come in," said this vision. I was ushered into a kitchen where a lady with a red face wearing a white coat with egg on the lapels poured out two schooners of sherry from a decanter labeled Cooking and handed one each to Gladys and me. Over the sherry, which even my untutored palate found lacking in finesse, I learned that Gladys was actually the upstairs maid in this imposing residence. Then she artlessly confided that her elegant clothes were cast-offs handed down to her by the two daughters of the family who employed her. What with the relief of finding Gladys was not out of reach after all and the unaccustomed drink, which had gone straight to my head, I left the house with Gladys on my arm and felt I was walking an inch above the ground all the way to the dance hall. Dancing with Gladys was to know the bliss of the perfect partner. She was light as thistle down in my arms and she followed my every lead unerringly as we glided effortlessly over the floor in tune with each other and with the occasion. By the end of the evening we were already planning our future as professional ballroom dancers. We thought we might first make our names in cabaret or by winning one of the big competitions, then we would open a school together and make our fortunes. We agreed to practice together every minute we could spare and we would go as a couple to all the local dances, not only to try out variations on all the latest steps to decent bands, but so that we might become known in the district as expert dancers, which might lead to invitations to give exhibition dances or even cabaret offers. Gladys and I especially enjoyed dancing the tango and on this, our first public appearance so to speak, our version of this beautiful dance pleased the crowd so much that they applauded and demanded an encore, just as I had dreamed might happen if ever I found a partner like Gladys. Few people learn to dance the tango well, they may master the steps and even feel its rhythm, but to do real justice to it one must have the right temperament and most English people are too stiff and too inhibited to let themselves go to the romantic sensuality which is its true meaning. When I left Gladys at the side door of her employer's mansion in the small hours we were already in imagination a world-famous dance team and we renewed our promises to work hard and often with kisses. In the weeks which followed we went to all the dances we could find and, according to plan, we became well known in the district as experts and we grew accustomed to applause and to graciously acceding to requests for an encore. Our personal relationship remained on the level of our ambitions, but often, moments which might have grown into tenderness were inhibited by Gladys' insistence that she was not that kind of a girl and she wanted none of that before her marriage lines were safely signed, sealed and delivered into her hand. The mere mention of marriage was like a cold shower to me. I remembered only too clearly the misery and discord in the seedy furnished room which had been my parents' home. But Gladys and I got on well enough and to dance with her was sheer delight. In the autumn of 1931 a local charity planned to hold a fundraising dance in the largest hall in St. Albans and the organizers asked Gladys and me to appear in the midnight cabaret without a fee, as our contribution to the cause. We were so sure this was our first rung on the ladder to fame and fortune, we accepted it with enthusiasm. We decided to dance our tango, By now a dramatized version with added steps of our own invention, and follow it with a quick step if we were asked for an encore. At this point Gladys revealed an unexpected propensity for managing and she announced we would wear Spanish costumes for the tango and I must chip in my share of the cost of materials and she would run them up on the Singer sewing machine at the house where she worked. It seemed to me time spent in sewing costumes would be better employed in practicing our act, but Gladys was determined we would make a dramatic impact and so I handed over my money. After endless discussions on the merits of various fabrics, Gladys contrived two very striking costumes, although I should say I was not too happy about the Cordoban hat she found for me to wear with mine. I was already conscious of being too short for professional dancing and I felt the hat would extinguish me completely, but Gladys was determined I should wear it, so I did. We were a terrific success on the big night and we finished our exhibition to prolonged, ear-splitting applause which was music to our ears and in acknowledgement I thankfully removed the hat. As Gladys gracefully curtsied and I bowed to the non-stop applause, both of us felt we only had to reach out and the career we wanted would be ours. Some weeks after our almost professional debut, Gladys and I were out walking when we passed a big old Victorian house in a residential part of town. The house belonged to two elderly sisters who ran a nursery school for the under fives called the Hall Nursery School. In those days women did not commonly work outside their homes and help in the nursery was cheap and readily available and the demand for places to dump burdensome tots was not so great as it is today, so I imagine the Hall School was rather less than a resounding financial success. As it happened, on this day there was a hand-printed notice pinned to one of the trees offering the school assembly hall for hire in the evenings at a reasonable fee for parties, lectures, soirees. Gladys and I stopped in our tracks, both struck by the same thrilling idea. Gladys' hazel eyes were dancing with excitement. "No harm in asking, is there?" she said, and we walked through the gateway. I tugged the old-fashioned bell pull and somewhere behind the massive front door a bell clanged. Shortly the door was opened by a quiet little mouse of a lady dressed in grey silk, who looked at us interrogatively without speaking. When we told her we wanted to ask about hiring the hall she thought we had better see her sister. We followed her into a room which was evidently a playroom for the children. There was a dapple grey rocking horse with splendid scarlet nostrils and a long tail standing in one corner, and other toys could be seen neatly stacked in an open cupboard. The elder sister, her hair in a frenzy, was painting a playpen with white paint. She looked up as the grey mouse sister ushered us into the room. She had a smudge of paint on the end of her nose. I asked politely if we could see the assembly hall with a view to hiring it on two evenings a week to teach ballroom dancing. The older lady remarked inconsequentially that they did not seem to dance the gavotte or the lance as much nowadays, but she supposed cats could look at kings. Miss Mouse seemed to take this last remark as permission for us to view the hall and she invited us to follow her. Gladys and I surveyed the parquet floor of what had once been the gracious drawing room of the house and, in spite of the damage that patterings of tiny feet had caused in the way of scratches and scuff marks, we nodded our satisfaction to each other. The room was ideal for our purpose. There was even a grand piano in the window bay and an old cabinet gramophone standing against the wall. Miss Mouse agreed that the gramophone was included in the hire, but said we would be responsible for any damage to the machine and must bring our own needles. We thought this was fair and said we would call again when we knew which nights we needed the hall. Then we bid the lady good afternoon and went away to talk things over. I was officially Gladys follower by now and sometimes the cook would give me a meal in the kitchen on nights when Gladys was housebound. On one such occasion, after the table was cleared, Gladys and I concocted a brochure advertising the Hall School of Dancing. Principals, L. Flint and G. Hayes. Our charges were 1 guinea for a course of 5 private lessons from one of the principals and 2 shillings per person per evening for the open class. Later we found a Backstreet printer who ran off 1,000 handbills from our copy, and we both spent hours of our spare time distributing these to factories and leaving them carelessly on shop counters or pushing them through the letterboxes of houses. Before too long, the Hall School of Dancing actually had pupils, and if we only had 2 people taking the Guinea course, we sometimes had as many as 20 in the open class. We had a problem with their music. The gramophone was wheezy and ancient, and we had very few records, and we spent so much time changing them from one side to the other and winding the gramophone, that pupils were complaining they were not getting their 2 shillings worth of tuition. We began to look around for someone to play the piano in return for the small fee we could offer, but without any success. One morning I was on the stepladder outside the shop polishing the show windows and doubtless thinking up new dance routines when a woman called to me from the pavement. I came down from the ladder to see who she was and recognized a lady who had sometimes acted as librarian at the Spiritualist Church in the days when I was going there. She introduced herself as Mrs. Mundin and said she had not seen me at the church for so long she felt she had to speak to me when she saw me on the steps. I thought she was probably in her early 40s but still very attractive, with a gaiety of manner which I found pleasing. I told her I had completely lost interest in spiritualism and my time was taken up trying to make a career for myself. "What a pity," said Mrs. Mundin. "I heard you were showing signs of quite outstanding mediumship in Mrs. Cook's home circle." Although it had happened so long before, I still felt myself turn scarlet at the memory of my disastrous final appearance in Mrs. Cook's circle. "I don't want to be a medium," I said firmly. "It seems a rotten kind of life to me." Mrs. Mundin looked sad and said it was a shame to waste a gift when there were so very few good mediums around. I answered that I probably wasn't any good anyway and I was too busy with this world to trouble myself about the next. Mrs. Mundin's level grey eyes disapproved of me. "If you have a gift, it is your duty to develop it and use it," she said. "I am starting a home circle and would be happy if you could join us." Not wanting to appear churlish, I smiled kindly as I shook my head. "Come to tea on Sunday and meet my friends," persisted the soft, pretty voice. "We will have tea and talk, then perhaps I will play the piano." I pricked up my ears. "Do you play dance music or the other kind?" I inquired brashly. When Mrs. Mundin said she played both kinds, I accepted her invitation. The minute I set foot in Mrs. Mundin's pretty little drawing room, it was obvious to me she and her friends were far above my station in life, and at first I was paralyzed with shyness and feelings of inferiority, which the silver tea service and the delicate cups and saucers on the tea trolley did nothing to dispel. Fortunately for me, Mrs. Mundin and her friends had that true gentility which never discomforts those who have been less privileged than themselves, and before long I found them as easy and relaxed as old shoes. After a delicious tea, Mrs. Mundin, who I was asked to call Edith, played Chopin, Brahms and Bach, and I had to admit to myself that these previously avoided composers appealed to me in a way I would never have expected. Then, to please me, Edith played all the latest dance tunes with such skill that my feet itched to dance. This was my first experience of a home where the criterion of acceptance was not who you were or where you came from, but what kind of human being you were. I knew instinctively that despite my uncertain grammar, my poverty and my lack of education, these people accepted me as one of themselves and they liked me. I wanted to see more of them, and so when the question of the circle came up, I agreed to sit with them every Wednesday evening, which was the one evening which would not interfere with any of my other activities. As I walked home, I wondered if I had been wise to start up all this spirit business again. I was determined to not let it interfere with my efforts to build up the whole school of dancing with Gladys, which reminded me that Gladys would probably be pretty scathing about the idea of me developing as a medium. I decided discretion was the better part of valor and I would keep my own counsel. I need hardly have worried on either score, because although I sat regularly every Wednesday evening in Edith's circle for many weeks, absolutely nothing happened, so far as any development of my psychic powers was concerned. I came to the conclusion that if I ever had any such powers, they must have left me forever. I would not have regretted this except for the disappointment I felt it must have been to the other members of the circle, who had heard such tales of my wonderful mediumship from members of Mrs. Cook's circle. Yet in all the long succession of blank evenings, not one member of the circle ever made me feel I had not come up to their expectations, and I began to feel a warm, genuine affection for each one of them. While we were sitting together as a circle, I could actually feel a warm tide of affection I diaresis negation owing from them towards me, and these blank evenings were certainly rewarding in the quiet joy of repose, tranquility and friendship we shared. What I did not realize until long afterwards was that during the months when nothing seemed to be happening, we ourselves were creating the very conditions of harmony and love in which the gift of mediumship can flower best. Gladys and I still had problems with our music. We had not found anyone who would play the piano for us at the very small fee we could offer. We struggled on with the gramophone, but we lost many pupils because of the long pauses caused by coping with the elderly machine. When Edith learned of our difficulty, she at once offered to play for us on two nights a week, and, although I knew she was having money worries herself at this time, she refused to accept any fee. Gladys had become very possessive, and I was apprehensive about her reaction to Edith, but the fact that we had acquired a first-class pianist for nothing outweighed her fear of losing me. Gladys went down considerably in my estimation when, after Edith had left for home at their first meeting, she said bitterly, "Your lady friend is well past it, isn't she?" One night when our circle was sitting as usual, suddenly the whole room seemed to grow icy cold and rush away from me, and I lost consciousness. When I returned to a normal waking state, I learned that various entities had spoken through me, including Edith's late husband, who had been the brother of Herbert Mundin, the comedy actor. As months passed, our circle became an ever more harmonious group. Sometimes I would be entranced, and discarnate persons would speak through me. At first these were relatives and friends of the other members of the circle, but that phase passed after a long period of time, until spiritually progressed beings from the other side began to speak through me on matters of philosophy and ethics. Edith would write down all that transpired while I was in trance, and when I returned to waking consciousness, I would marvel at the learned discourses and the cultured language which had come through my lips. After a further long period of months, a new facet of my mediumship developed, and I became clairvoyant. I could see and describe the spirit people who gathered around us during our sittings. As I saw them, they were as solid and lifelike as any other member of the group, but they had the same disconcerting habit of vanishing abruptly as the people I had seen as a child. Eventually, Edith's money problems became so acute she had to give up her little house. She could no longer afford the rent, so she and her son Owen, a bright attractive child of 9, moved into a council house on the outskirts of St. Albans, and Edith took a job trimming hats in a local factory. But during this time of change and disruption, there was no break in the regular sitting of our circle. Our meeting place was changed to the house of two other members, so that the development of my mediumship would not suffer. On the nights when I was not sitting with the circle, I still went to local dances with Gladys or taught in our school. But Gladys became ever more suspicious because I would never see her on Wednesday nights, however desirable a dance was being held, and she openly began to demand what was the attraction which made Wednesday evenings so sacred. I knew very well she would either laugh at me or nag me unbearably to try and make me give up the circle, so I never told her anything more than that. It was my own business. My gallivantings with Gladys were also causing trouble with my grandmother. In spite of the fact I was 22 years of age, she still refused to allow me a front door key of my own. This meant that when I was out late dancing, either she sat up to let me into the house, which she did with the air of an affronted archangel, or she would go to bed and I would have to throw pebbles up at George's window to waken him from his beery stupor to come down and let me in. I hardly knew which alternative was the more grisly, but the situation certainly led to many exacerbating rows in our house. I began to dread going home from work to have to face an embattled grandmother, or I diaresis negation our verbal abuse from George, or even a concerted attack by both. Edith was not very happy at this time either. She had moved far away from the friends and neighbors she knew and had been used to for company. Neither had she had made any new friends among her neighbors on the council estate. I thought perhaps it was because they resented her superior education and her more intellectual interests. But apart from Wednesday nights when our circle met, she was very lonely. So I formed the habit of dropping in to see her and young Owen on nights when I had no other engagement, rather than stay at home in the grim atmosphere generated by my grandmother and George. Edith was always flatteringly pleased to see me, and she always had time and patience to listen to my problems and to give me advice and comfort. I liked Owen very much too, and I began to look on him as the young brother I had never had, and I think he grew quite fond of me. I remember once, the day after Christmas, Edith and I planned a treat for him. We pooled our money and took the early train to London, where we queued for tickets at Drury Lane Theatre. After a long wait, we managed to get seats in the stalls to see the marvellous pantomime which the theatre used to present every Christmas. After the show, we ate at Leon Corner House to the accompaniment of a string orchestra before returning to St. Albans on the late train. We had a glorious outing, and the total cost for the three of us was no more than 30 shillings. I did not know it any more than did the other members of our circle, but the development of my mediumship was entering its final and most important phase. I was still very much Ydiarus's negation LM fan, and I would go to the cinema as often as I could to see the talkies, to which I had now become quite reconciled, but every time I sat in the comfortable dark of the cinema, with my eyes glued to the screen, I became aware of strange whisperings going on around me. I could catch only an odd word here and there, but the voices were those of both men and women, and it was made very clear to me that other members of the audience could also hear them, because I was constantly being told to shut up, or else I was thumped angrily on the back by those sitting behind me. I would protest that I had not opened my mouth, but as the whisperings continued and more people began to complain, I would eventually have to crawl unhappily out of the cinema without seeing the Ydiarus's negation LM. This happened so often that I had to give up going to the cinema altogether. I now know that this was the earliest manifestation of the voice mediumship which was to bring me fame, if not fortune, and it was made possible by the fact I was sitting in the darkness of the auditorium surrounded by many people, whose minds were concentrated on the screen to the exclusion of random or distracting thoughts. But at the time it puzzled me and deprived me of one of my greatest pleasures. Things at home got more unpleasant. I would not give up my late night dancing, and my grandmother adamantly refused to hand over a latch key, and the constant discord in the house made me moody, depressed and miserable. Edith came to my rescue and offered to turn her box room into a bedroom for me, if I would care to be her lodger at a rent of a few shillings a week, to include breakfast before I went to work. And so, without regret on either side, I left my grandmother's house, which had been my home for so many years, and moved into Edith's council house as her paying guest. Under Edith's care and in the peace of her home, I grew happier and more contented, and, doubtless because of the greater harmony within myself, the development of my voice mediumship accelerated, and we began to get the voices in our home circle. At first more of the confused whisperings, later strong clear voices who announced themselves as the persons they had been on Earth, giving their names and addresses and telling us about their lives on Earth. To my joy, I was no longer taken into trance while these manifestations took place, so I too could now hear and appreciate everything that went on in the circle. Indeed, I could even hold intelligent conversations with some of the spirit entities who were able to manifest through my mediumship, and I can still do so today. For a long time after this acceleration of my development in the circle, I had been torn between my desire for a career as a professional dancer with Gladys and the constant urging by spirit entities that I must give up everything to serve and comfort humanity through my mediumship. I still hankered after the lights and the applause of a professional dancer's life, and I simply could not make up my mind to give up the idea altogether. For a long time I tried to get the best of both worlds in a literal sense, and while Wednesday night was reserved for the other side, The other nights of the week were devoted to furthering the ambitions of Gladys and myself. I was wandering down the main street in St. Albans one Saturday afternoon window shopping, making my way among the housewives and fathers doing their weekend buying. There seemed to be more people about than usual this Saturday, and I was pleased to see Gladys walking towards me through the crowds, although lately she and I had had many quarrels because of her possessive jealousy, which had grown almost pathological.